ahead and take the speed up your number one now, runway 27 clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems. I'm one of your hosts, Tom Charpentier, EAA Government Relations Director. Sitting across from me,
I'm your other host. My name is Chris Henry. I'm the EAA Aviation Museum Director. Tom, you know, as you know, my favorite episodes, which most are ones that we have a special guest. And today we have just that. We have Tom Carr with us. He is the Chief Test Pilot from Garmin. Tom, thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
My favorite question to get us rolling, I ask everybody on here, what was the first thing that really sort of lit your fuse about airplanes? What really got you into it?
I'm not sure there's a single thing. I'm originally from Washington, D.C., was interested in aviation from the very beginning. My father was in the Air Force, actually Air Corps, but I can't say that really drove me one way or the other.
Wow. Do you have a core memory of maybe interacting with an airplane, or did he ever take you out to see an airplane or anything like that, or tell you about it?
He never really took me out or tried to get me interested in it, but it's the sort of thing back when I was a kid, airplanes were really cool. You know, you would go on driving vacations, not flying vacations. And so there was a real mystique around airplanes. At the time, National Airport, now Reagan, was the closest airport to me. And so I was an airport rat, but I was an airport rat at DCA. So maybe the only airport rat I know of that started at National.
That's awesome. Just clinging to the fence, watching airplanes. And
at the time you could walk up, knock on the door to the control tower and they'd let you up there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You just climb the stairs up and they'd point out airplanes to you. It was incredible. You could walk up. This is back when airplanes would come in, go up the, pull up to the gate, everybody'd get off, and they wouldn't then immediately start loading people on. The airplane might sit there 3 or 4 or 5 hours until it was ready to go. And there was no TSA. I'm talking about a 12-year-old kid just walks up, climbs into the airplane, goes up and sits in the cockpit.
Wow.
It was beautiful.
Wow. Can you tell me, do you remember some of the types maybe that you had seen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everything from, there were Viscounts, Electras were still flying into DCA, DC-9s, 727s. The 727 was the largest airplane. It didn't have any four-engine jet airplanes. Those went into Dulles.
Oh, that's cool.
As a policy guy, I know DCA very well. In fact, I'm flying in there on Tuesday.
Yeah. They won't let you up in the tower.
They won't let you up in the tower anymore. Definitely not. There's that little viewing point, it's just past the approach to one of the runways in one of the parks there. And I also know that there's a college sailing team in. I'm a sailor. I sailed in college, and there's a college sailing team in D.C. They sail on the Potomac, and they know how to time the passing aircraft right to play the wingtip vortices. To get ahead.
That's cool. Intel.
Yeah,
it's valuable exactly. In peacetime too.
Yeah. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So beyond so obviously DCA isn't exactly the ideal place to take the next step to actually learn to fly. Where did that happen?
No, actually that started at DCA as
really?
Well. But you're right, was not an ideal place to start because there was a $4 per landing fee even when I started in a 150. So, I mean, we didn't stay around and do touch and goes there at DCA.
But so you're flying 150s out of DCA?
Correct.
Wow.
No, there was an active FBO there. As a matter of fact, I used to go there, and I mean, I'll out myself. I think the statute of limitations has expired. I used to go into the FBO there at Page was the FBO, and I'd steal their magazines. So they'd have BCA, and they'd have Pro Pilot, and so I'd take their magazines, and so that's kind of how I cut my teeth on aviation.
Oh, no kidding.
Wow. That's really wild. Did you have a planned course, or what were your thoughts of where you were going to end up in aviation?
There wasn't really a planned course for the piloting side of it. I thought I'd like to be an airline pilot. So I knew I'd have to go to college. At the time, they preferred college graduates. And so I went to school at the University of Kansas to get a degree in aerospace engineering. And the idea was to really get something that would be attractive to an airline to hire me and make enough money that I could actually fly, get enough hours that I could be an airline pilot. So that there really wasn't a real impetus to fly immediately. It was to really kind of build those blocks towards getting an airline pilot job someday.
So tell us about the path that did take place. Where did you go after flight school and into college?
So I did a little bit of flying in college. Of course, I started at DCA, did not get certificated as a pilot. Same thing in college. I flew a little bit in college at the University of Kansas, but really did most of my flying after I left college, went to Beech Aircraft in Wichita. And at that time, the goal was get a job as an engineer, make enough money to fly, get an airline pilot job. So that's really where I got most of my flying time, was after I left college and in Wichita.
And what did you do in Wichita?
So I took a job right out of college with Beech Aircraft as a control system design engineer. And I spent about a year as a control system design engineer and then transferred into flight test, which that was the first time they had an opening. And so I've been in flight test ever since. After I started learning the ropes of test flying, I really kind of gave up on the airline pilot idea and decided I really wanted to stay in flight test.
I don't think, regardless of branch of the service or company you're with, that the phrase flight test doesn't sound pretty cool. That's where you're going to go work. That's what department you're in. What really excited you about going into the flight test area?
So I was an engineer, and flight test is really kind of a combination of engineering, flying skills. A lot of different things go into developing and certifying an airplane. And I liked doing that. I like being involved in the engineering aspect. I like to be involved in flying of different airplanes, new stuff, cool stuff, different stuff. And it turned out to be really more interesting than what I really perceived the airline job to be.
What was kind of the, career path, if you will, into the flight test world? Like, did you start with, comparatively minor changes, systems, things like that, and then proceed to new production, or how did that work?
So Beech and a lot of general aviation manufacturers have a path forward for non-military people. Beech in particular had kind of a tripartite way of developing and using test pilots. They would hire military-trained test pilot school graduates. They would hire military-trained but not test pilot-trained. And they would hire civilian pilots and train them. And so you kind of got a blend of all these different styles. And military pilots were, of course, very good at things like store separation, weapons delivery, things like that. And
do a lot of that with the Bonanzas, right?
Yeah. but keep in mind, Beech did do a lot of military.
That's true. Yeah.
Did a lot of military work. We had T-34, T-44. We had C-12s delivered all over to military. So a lot of reconnaissance, RC aircraft. So RC meaning reconnaissance, not radio controlled. So the way they would train pilots would be to start you off doing data analysis. So you'd look at the data and learn what constituted good data, what constituted good air, what you needed to do with the data to show certification or to show compliance with whatever the requirements were, whether it was certification, internal, whatever. And after you kind of learn what's going to happen to the data you take, they start working you into the right seat of the airplane, doing taking data during test flights. And in that point, you're learning how the tests are done. So you now know what happens to the data. You learn now how to do the tests. And as you start learning how to do the tests, how to, prosecute a flight test program, a certification program, that sort of thing, you start getting worked into doing the test work yourself as a test pilot. At Beech, we were lucky. We had everything from Skippers, Duchess, Sundowners, Bonanzas, up to Barons, King Airs, Jets. So we had the ability to really kind of start off in smaller programs, smaller aircraft, and build yourself up to the point where you had done all of it through a full development and certification program, and then you were ready to do it on your own with a larger airplane.
Awesome.
But the same thing is true of anybody they would hire. It would be very rare, even for a test pilot school graduate, to come in and go straight into a test pilot job. They'd have to learn really how to do certification. They'd learn how to do it the way Beach liked to do it, how to set up a program, how we did the test for FAA certification as opposed to military mil-spec qualifications and that sort of thing. So you had that kind of training program regardless of how you got into that job in the first place.
I know this is a vast oversimplification that I'm asking you to do, but how would you, in general, describe your job as a test pilot, your job in flight testing?
Well, you're right. Normally, when you say it's simplification, those are really exactly in my alley. But I can't really say. So simplification is taking a concept. It's determining if the airplane or the system performs its job according to what you envision that concept doing. And if it does, you then market it to whatever organization you're trying to develop it for. If it's for the civilian market, well, then you're going to try to certify it with the FAA. If it's something more like surveillance, well, then you're dealing with the military, sometimes the military and the FAA. So it's really a determination that whatever product you're on meets its requirements. If there's a simplification there, it's saying, we have a need, and we're going out and seeing if this airplane system, whatever, meets that need.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. And I think, you know, kind of digging into the nuts and bolts of piloting the aircraft during flight test, I had a very small role in developing the flight test manual that we do for EAA. And one thing that really struck me was it's all about creating the conditions under which the experiment that you're performing can be conducted. So it's a lot of precision and data collection.
That if you read some of the manuals or some of the books that people have put out like that, you'll find out that that's kind of what they say is, it's really being able to tighten your standards so that you can fly precisely, create those conditions such that you can actually show that what you think it's going to do is going to do it. Because minor variations can make major differences in the end result.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you remember the first test flight you undertook, and what was it?
I do. It was for litigation, and I think I probably better not talk about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the first ones that I would talk about, we were developing a new external configuration in C-12s. And the C-12 has various versions called RC-12s. And each one of these different models of RC-12 has a different configuration of external antennas, chaff dispensers, flare dispensers, IR detectors, things like that. And the great thing about being on that kind of a program is that you're always out doing the fun stuff, the stability and control. You're doing the stalls, you're doing really the cool stuff and not doing system development work and that sort of thing. So being on a program like that, and so I believe the first one I actually was on may have been the RC-12D, but it was really a great program to cut your teeth on as a test pilot because you're out there doing the for real stability and control testing, kind of honing your skills.
That's an interesting airplane, by the way. I don't think I realized how much they did until my sister-in-law is at a base that has them, and what an active platform that aircraft is.
It is really great. It's a really great platform to go out and, like I say, for a test pilot, it's your bread and butter. You get to go out and do all the things you like to do, and there's a lot of things you really don't care to do. Some system development work is just kind of plug and chug, not very interesting at all, but stability and control, performance, stalls, handling qualities, that's really the interesting stuff for me.
Well, I think, you know, when we hear test flying, you think of maybe some flying that's out there on the edge, or you get an unexpected result. Have you ever experienced test flying in an airplane and something didn't go exactly how you planned?
Yes. I'm trying to think back on some of the ones that I can talk about. So the ones that have happened most consistently have to do with spin testing. And I've done quite a few spin test programs. I like doing them. And we were doing a spin test program on three Baron models, Baron being a twin-engine, piston-driven aircraft. And on a number of occasions, it didn't recover. It spun just fine. Didn't recover, but just fine. So we ended up having to deploy the spin recovery parachute on a number of occasions. So those are times that I can't say I was really surprised, but it didn't really go according to what we wanted it to do.
Yeah, spin testing is always always a little hairy, even when it goes right. But
it is. But again, it's kind of, to me, it's that's the fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
No. So,
yeah.
So do you on something like a spin test in a Baron? Do you wear a parachute or anything, or is the parachute on the plane?
Can I say hell yes?
Yeah, okay,
yeah, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
You would have a we call it a rip hinge door, but it's really basically a door where the pins are to the hinge are hooked to a single handle. You pull the handle, and that door's still going to fly away. Typically, a spin recovery parachute on the tail, a backpack parachute, plus all the normal things, helmet, flight suit, that sort of thing, boots, the whole ball of wax. You treat it like for real thing. So, unfortunately, in some instances, especially when you're talking about litigation, when you do a spin test program with a spin recovery parachute on the tail, you need to go out and do it without a spin recovery parachute on the tail, because unfortunately they will then make the case that the airplane only recovered because you had this spin recovery parachute on the tail, even if you didn't use it. So you have to go remove it, go back to the stock airplane configuration, and repeat some of the spins just to show that it did not have any effect on the recovery characteristics of the airplane. So that, yes, I have a parachute on my back. Normally, I would have a parachute on the tail, not always.
It's interesting. You talked to several times about litigation, and I know that there's a limit to what you could say about any individual case, but I didn't realize that was a major part of a test pilot's life at an airframer. Basically going out and recreating circumstances where an attorney claims that an aircraft may have failed, things like that.
I'm not going to say it's a major part. Part of the reason it was a major part of my job is because I was a senior test pilot, and I had flown a number of the airplanes for which we were involved in litigation. So it's not necessarily going out and showing what happened, because in a lot of cases, what's being claimed, we know didn't happen.
Right.
So it's actually going out and showing that what was claimed didn't happen.
Got it.
Wow. And was it on this path that you end up working on the Starship program?
So I was at the time a flight test engineer working my way into doing flight tests and starting on some of the smaller aircraft. And when the Starship was started, it really was a concept back in the 70s. But the idea of taking that concept into a production airplane started in earnest in about 1982. I was assigned to the program in 83 to help set up the Starship flight test program.
The stories we have today are really interesting, but before we go any further, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor. They are some of the people who help make the Green Dot possible, and That is Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, you can save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15. That's GREEN15 at crewchiefsystems.com. Thank you again so much to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot and helping make it possible. Now let's get back to the rest of the story.
So before we get too much farther into the Starship, because I'm excited for this, I love the Starship, we should probably describe to any folks who found their way to this podcast without clicking on the link, which I'm sure is going to have a big picture of a Starship on it, what exactly the Starship is and what it looks like.
So the Starship is a canard twin pusher turboprop aircraft. So pusher means the engines are turned around such that propellers are on the back of the engine, not on the front. In the case of the Starship, it's an all-composite aircraft, and it's intended as a business aircraft. So it started out as a 12,500-pound aircraft. Anybody that's familiar with the King Air knows that it was started essentially as a replacement for the King Air. It ended up as a almost 15,000-pound airplane, 14.9. So all composite, twin turboprop, pusher, canard aircraft, I guess, is the short answer for what it is.
There's just nothing else that even looks like it.
And no.
If you're listening to this and you've never seen it, you have to Google it. I mean,
yeah, I mean, you look at it, you immediately know that it's a it's a canard in the same tradition as the other Rutan designs, like the Long Easy and things like that. But yeah, it's certainly no business aircraft, other than maybe the Piaggio that looked like that.
Yeah, exactly. So can you walk us through a little bit of how you ended up on the program? Were you invited on, or did you apply to get onto that program?
No, as a matter, I was asked to take over as the lead flight test engineer in 82 to help set up the flight test program. At the time, we had started to work on contracting with Burt Rutan to build the 85% proof of concept airplane. So I stayed back, set up the flight test program, did a lot of the development work on some of the pieces and parts, the avionics, pressurization system, things like that, while the chief test pilot of the Starship at the time was out at Scaled starting to fly the airplane. I also flew the airplane out at Scaled, but really my job was to develop the systems back in Wichita and then fly on the full-scale airplanes when they flew.
Wow. Could you tell us about what some of the systems are that you worked on?
So the idea with the Starship was to try to aggressively use new technology. So one of those things was an all-electronic flight deck. So we developed the avionics for the airplane. We had a test bed, King Air 200 test bed, and I'll talk about that a little bit tonight. We had a King Air 300, which was a pressurization system test bed. We had a lot of different test beds that we used to develop individual pieces and parts that would eventually coalesce into the full-scale airplane.
Wow. That had to be interesting. Did the King Airs fly any different with the different equipment? Like, would they handle a lot different?
So what we would do is typically make one side of an airplane the test side, and then the other side would stay. So, for example, when we had the 200 that we used as a avionics test bed, the avionics were installed in the right side of the airplane, and the left side stayed electromechanical with mechanical engine gauges and that sort of thing. And so we could do anything we wanted to do with the airplane, and we didn't have to worry that if any of the avionics started to malfunction, that we wouldn't have get home capability. It was not a problem. And they never did. They were Collins Avionics. They were solid.
So one thing I know about those avionics that I think is really fascinating is that it was a pre GPS quasi moving map system. Can you describe a little bit about how that worked?
Sure. So it did not have GPS, but it did have an FMS. So FMSs were in widespread use really by the time the Starship came out. The Collins had an FMS called the FMS-90, and it kind of transitioned into what was called the FMS-850 for the Starship program. And it used primarily VLF Omega for long-range nav. But domestically, if you have VOR and DME, it can actually give a position solution using DME that's just about as accurate as GPS.
So it's kind of frequency hopping between the different VORs to kind of triangulate your position.
And it would always do that
in
the background.
Yeah.
You could say, on your display, you could always display whatever VOR DME you wanted. But in the background, it's always looking at the closest six DMEs and trying to triangulate a position off of them. And then you use that for your moving map.
Wow. Pretty impressive.
It is. I mean, the airplane sounds like at the time it was ahead of its time. I mean, really.
It was ahead of its time. And a lot of the things that we thought would be the very high risk areas turned out not to be high risk at all. The composites, canard, things like that. All the things that we thought would be big issues for us were not. But we didn't spend as much time developing the systems as we should have. And in the end, I think if we'd spent more attention to developing systems, making them more reliable, they'd still be building that airplane today.
Can you talk a little bit more about flying a Canard aircraft? How did it handle differently than, say, a King Air as a benchmark?
So what we found was that most of the surfaces didn't have the kind of control effectiveness that the King Air, for example, had. So it was heavy in all axes. It's not a sporty airplane. That's okay. No, nobody buys those airplanes to be sporty. The actual cabin itself was very nice. The avionics were rock solid. But as far as flying it goes, I don't think if you put somebody in the seat and said, okay, tell me what airplane you're in, I don't think they could tell you they were in a King Air or a Starship. You have to make it so that anybody can fly it. You know, if only Steve Canyon can fly it, you're only going to sell one, and that's to Steve Canyon.
That's fair enough. What was it like to land? Because that's one thing I was thinking about with a Canard is that the Canard stalls before the main wing. So if you go anywhere near a full landing stall, you're going to plunk the nose, right?
If you ever really did that, that's true. But when you get into ground effect, you would have to really work hard to stall that Canard. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure out of hundreds, maybe thousands of landings, I'm not sure I ever actually stalled the Canard on landing.
Okay.
So
I was just curious about that. Sorry, Chris, I stole your thunder.
No, that's we're hanger flying.
You can tell I'm really
this is great. This is awesome. It always amazed me because when it lands, it looks like you're way out ahead of everything, Did it, was the approach at all different in it or anything like that?
So the flap and the forward wing or the Canard were electrically interconnected. When the flaps went down, the Canard went forward. When the flaps came up, the Canard swept aft. So that you had virtually no trim change or pitch change when you put the flaps down. And it worked very well. Actually, I believe Burt Rutan has the patent on that system. So the airplane itself doesn't have a real change in approach. But the only thing I would say might be different from most pilots' perspective when you land the airplane is normally power is destabilizing an attractor airplane, which means the nose is going to start pitching up. So when you bring the power back, the nose pitches down in a flare, in a King Air, a Baron, something like that. And the Starship's the opposite. We had a very high thrust line with power. So when you brought the power in, nose pitched down. When you brought the power back, the nose pitched up. So it's actually a little bit different, but you accommodate it because really you're closing the loop on pitch attitude anyway, and you just subconsciously adjust it such that you fly the pitch attitude you want to fly in the flare.
Wow. That's incredible. How did you enjoy the test program? Did you enjoy flying the Starship?
Oh, yeah. That was, you know, just a fantastic learning program for a test pilot. You learned about all kinds of different aerodynamics, systems, different ways the airplane flew, different things you could do to change. When you found something that didn't work, you got to do a lot of cool things to change it. I flew out at Scaled Composites in the 85% proof of concept. You got to see how another company did that, a company that basically flew test airplanes all the time. And if you needed to make a change, they could do it overnight. I mean, big changes, they could do it overnight. It was incredible.
How did the 85% scale mock-up fly?
It was a nasty little airplane.
Was it?
I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that, but really it was not a fun airplane to fly. It wow. It had pretty high friction in most axes, and especially in yaw. And you could step on the rudder, and when you took your foot away, it'd stay right there. So That's just very high friction. So you had to fly it all the time, and it had no environmental systems. So no air conditioning, no heating. So you're talking about an airplane that might be flying in Mojave in the summer, and it's 100 degrees, and we've got flight suits and helmets and parachutes, and maybe if we're going out to altitude, got an oxygen mask on, and it's freaking hot.
Oh, wow.
And you might be doing low altitude work. So, you know, it's hot, no air conditioning. But the flip side of that is we also would go to 41,000 feet unpressurized, and we had no heat. The only heat was a very small radiant heater that was up by the pilot's feet. That's the only heat you had, and it got cold. So, as a matter of fact, I had a flight test engineer that got frostbite.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Yeah,
sheesh. What did you learn aerodynamically from the 85% that you brought to the full scale?
So you learned a lot of good things. It identified some things that needed to be fixed, like we needed to cure some of the spanwise flow along that wing. And I think Bert invented Vortilons for that. But we also got kind of misled into thinking that some things weren't going to be a problem, and in the full-scale airplane, they were, like flap forward wing asymmetry.
That's incredible. Do you have a favorite flight you ever took in the Starship, or one that stands out for you?
You should ask me that before so I could have thought about it. Favorite flight. We did a lot of takeoff and landing performance. And one reason was that the airplane kept going up in weight, ended up having to swap out from steel brakes to carbon-powered brakes. We had ended up having to put a pusher on the airplane that changed the stall speed. So we ended up doing takeoff and landing, or what we call field performance tests. I think 5 full deployments before we even certified the first time. And that is really fun stuff. So you're taking off, you know, you're whacking an engine while you're still on the runway, still taking off. That's really fun stuff. So I liked doing that just because you're validating what everybody has predicted and showing whether it's really going to work.
When you walked out, you know, I would imagine, at least this is how I'm built, you know, when you're walking out to test fly an airplane that like a Baron or a King Air, you know, it's a long history. The airplane looks like the next line of that type, you know, a 300 or 400 or whatever. There had to be some maybe cool feeling of walking out to go test fly a Starship, and it looks just like a test airplane. I mean, looks like an X airplane that you would think of.
And that's true. You're absolutely true. You go out there, you know you're on the latest development aircraft in the world, in the civilian world. But I will tell you that almost all of those airplanes that you're talking about, whether it's a Bonanza, a Baron, a King Air, whatever, they all have some little idiosyncrasies that when you walk out to it, you better not think it's not going to bite me today.
That's very good. Yeah, good thinking, I guess. Yeah.
So I guess just wrapping up on the Starship, I think, you know, obviously it didn't pan out the way that Beechcraft you guys were hoping.
It was Raytheon Aircraft by that time.
Raytheon, excuse me. I'm sorry.
The Beech family's, you know,
yeah,
they're doing about 50,000 RPM in their grave right now.
Yeah, I gotcha. But it does not remain in production today. And, you know, several examples were built and all that. A couple still fly today. But there's got to be a legacy here, right? There was stuff that you developed on that aircraft that is still, that were lessons learned for the fleet today. And even though there's nothing quite like it out there right now, there's got to be some stuff that was developed in that program that was carried forward.
I think that's probably true, but since Beech Aircraft doesn't exist anymore, it was bought by Raytheon, which was then sold to a consortium of people that didn't have any experience in GA. I think it was called Onyx and Goldman Sachs. You know, then they sold it, I believe, at bankruptcy auction to Textron. So it's hard to say how much of any of those systems or aerodynamics fixes, things like that, actually kept migrating its way through to today's product line. I can tell you a lot of the things that we had were cutting edge at the time, and nowadays they're just kind of normal. So automatic pressurization systems, things like that. Did it come about as a result of the Starship? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's fair enough. I'm sure there was some R&D on, you know, things like composite aircraft and stuff like that, that were lessons learned for the industry, but it's kind of hard to point to exactly what.
True. And a lot of the stuff that I think that they learned on things like composites, they applied to other airframes, not necessarily Beech. At one time, we had more composites, weight of composites on the C-17 than we had on the Starship.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So the lessons you learn may not necessarily have been related to that airframe, but they were related to what you had to do to get that airframe certified.
Yeah,
fair enough. How do you feel when you walk into, it's got to be maybe an interesting feeling to walk into like a museum and see one. What's your first gut reaction?
Honestly, I let it go, right? I've had what I would say probably 5 or 6 once in a career programs, and I've loved them all. Starship was a great program. I walked away from it when it was time. And so more often, instead of walking into a museum and seeing one there, I'll get something from someone, from my son, from somebody else who says, I saw NC so-and-so in this museum. Did you fly that one? So
that's cool.
Yeah. So that is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so what was next after you left the Starship program?
After I left the Starship program, I got assigned to what was at the time called the JPATS program, Joint Primary Aircraft Training System, that was was competition to replace the T-37 for the Air Force, T-34 for the Navy. And we were partnered with Pilatus and their PC-9 to create what is now the T-6A, which is the primary trainer. We won the contract. So that's the primary trainer now for the Air Force and the Navy and militaries around the world. After that, I was assigned to the Horizon program, the Hawker Horizon, which was the follow-on to the Hawker line. And I made the first flight on that airplane in 2001. And of course, when Textron bought the company, they did not elect to continue building the Horizon, but they did take a lot of the pieces and parts and put it on their latest aircraft. So those were the kind of the two major programs that I had after the Starship before I left the company in 2003.
Now in 2003, is that when you decided to join Garmin?
That's correct.
Wow.
In 2003, I went to Garmin as their chief test pilot, and that lasted about 2 months. And then I was named the director of flight operations and chief test pilot. And then just recently stepped back, gave up the director duties, and now I'm the chief test pilot again.
And what kind of fun stuff do you test at Garmin? Like what does a day look like as a test pilot at the Garmin facility?
So I've been involved in
virtually all the R&D that we've done in the last 20 years, starting with the certification of the G1000 and then certification of our first autopilots. Then probably most recently culminating in the certification of our Autoland. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but Autoland, you push a button and the airplane will take you to the nearest suitable airport, land the airplane, shut the engine down.
Didn't someone for the first time just use it a few weeks ago, right?
Just about a month ago, correct.
Yeah. And it worked just like they thought it would.
Just according to Hoyle.
Wow. That had to be a pretty good feel-good moment for everybody.
It is. It is. It's nice to know the system worked fine. It's nice to know somebody relied on it. I believe we may have had a previous save already because the airplane will take you down to 15,000 feet. If it's a depressurization event, it'll take you down to 15,000 feet. And if somebody comes to and takes the airplane back, you really did save it, but you're not going to get credit for it.
Yeah.
So did you fly the first full landing to touchdown with the system?
So we actually had four different prototypes to test. And the first one actually was in a Columbia 400. And no, one of my pilots did the first landing in that Columbia. And then we had a number of other test platforms. And the final certification test platform for us was a Piper M600. And I did do the first full auto land in that one.
So be honest, were you like, you know, kind of like a nervous flight instructor, you know, just kind of defensive position as it was round out and flaring?
That is exactly what it was like.
Yeah.
It was exactly like being a flight instructor and knowing that at any time somebody can do something that you don't like. And as a flight instructor, you probably know right up until the end, you have the ability to intercede. And in development, we interceded many times. So that's what development's about.
Sure.
Wow. Well, Tom, I we can have a whole nother episode just about the Autoland.
And you should, by the way.
I'll take you up on that offer. Okay. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being here. You're here as part of our speaker series. You're going to be speaking tonight in the museum. So everybody that's hearing this now, you know, Tom had been here. We encourage you to look at our schedule and see if you can. If you're in the area, make a trip out to the speaker series. We're in for a good show tonight, I have no doubt. Can't wait to go out and talk Starship tonight. So, Tom, do you want to take us home?
Sure, I certainly can. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for being out here. Like I said, the Starship, I think I saw a show on TV when I was a little kid about Cunard aircraft, and it's just stuck with me ever since. And I know the Starship was on there. It was probably still in development when that show was made, and it's been great talking to somebody who was there throughout the development. That's amazing, and I'll be there tonight, and I'm really excited to see your presentation, see your slides. That'll be great. Yeah. Thanks, Chris, for putting together a fantastic speaker series and continuing to do a lot of the production work on this show, of course. Thank you to our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems, for keeping us on the air and supporting the program. And for everybody else listening out there, we'll see you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.